Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Amphibians with extra legs, alligators with stunted genitals, intersex fish, and now evidence of increasing genital abnormalities in human newborns. The culprit, scientists say, endocrine disruptors, chemicals widely used in agriculture, industry, manufacturing, and baby bottles, chemicals widely found in the water. There are serious questions about whether the U.S. government is doing enough to protect us. A new study says, watch out. This hour, On Point, endocrine disruptors and their long reach. You can join the conversation. Do you know what's in the tap water, the bottled water, the baby bottle? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is R. Thomas Zeller, professor of biology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and one of the authors of a landmark statement published last month by the Endocrine Society that's being received as a striking wake-up call on a frightening class of chemicals. Tom Zeller, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
With us also from Washington is Lynn Goldman, a pediatrician, epidemiologist, and professor of environmental health sciences and health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She's principal investigator on a study that's looking at the effects of environmental influences on the health and development of 100,000 children across the United States, following them from before birth to age 21. She served 5 years under President Clinton as assistant administrator of the EPA's Office of Prevention, Pesticides, and Toxic Substances. Lynn Goldman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
It's scary to read about. It doesn't sound exactly new, and I want to ask you about that. We seem to have been hearing these warnings for a while, but introduce us first, if you would, Lynn, to what are we talking about when we're talking about endocrine disruptors? How do they get into our environment, into the bodies of humans and animals, and their consequences that are emerging?
Well, how they get into our environment is a number of ways, sometimes on purpose, such as through application of pesticides, and sometimes not on purpose, such as releases that are industrial releases that occur maybe in manufacture of products, maybe in disposal of waste. And sometimes they're actually in the products that we use as consumers. They have worked their way into numerous kinds of products through being used in plastics and being used in just a multitude of purposes. And I think what's happened is that for a number of years in environmental health, we were very focused on cancer, and we were not paying enough attention to endocrine disruptors, even though it was right in front of our face. And what I mean by that is one of the first things that really raised the awareness of the public about the environment was the discovery of the effects that DDT had on bird populations. And what was it doing? It was causing thinning of bird shells, birds' eggshells, and preventing the reproduction of birds. So birds were disappearing all over the country and, in fact, all over the world. And that, in fact, was through endocrine disruption. But yet, we really didn't start thinking about it that way, nor looking for other things that might be causing endocrine disruption until, you know, within the last decade or so. And since we've been looking for those things, then the knowledge has been exploding, literally exploding.
It seems, once you start looking at this, that they're just about everywhere. A lot in the kitchen, the lining of most U.S. food cans, canned foods, the lining there has these chemicals. There's lots of kitchenware that's made from plastic, baby bottles. But start with animals with us, if you would, because the reports there have been the most kind of head-turning so far. There's plenty with humans now, but I mean, what is it about this class of chemicals that leads us with five-legged salamanders and male bass in the Potomac River? 80% of them they're finding producing eggs in males, which they should not be doing, I guess. What is it about these chemicals?
No, males are not supposed to ovulate. No. And what it is that in the environment and wildlife in particular have been impacted by some of these chemicals because of their ability to bioaccumulate in the food chain to get levels higher and higher and higher as you move up the food chain. And so we've seen these very strong results in, you mentioned the alligators and the feminization of the male alligators that's been found, because, of course, the alligator is a top predator. It's a top food chain species. And these alligators happen to be in areas where there had been a lot of pesticide use, like DDT and another pesticide called Dicofol. And so in a sense, you know, the alligators and other species have been like the canary in the coal mine for us. And in fact, the signals that we've received from studies of wildlife have been much stronger than other signals. I mean, in the first place, the lab studies that were being conducted for regulatory reasons weren't looking at endocrine effects for a long time. And so chemicals would get kind of a seal of approval through these laboratory studies that weren't actually properly looking for endocrine endpoints. That's a problem. And second, it's very difficult to look at these things in humans because, you know, we're very complicated. We have very complicated series of lifestyles and exposures and so forth. We're complicated genetically, and we don't have good histories often of early life exposures. What was going on in utero that might be affecting the development of the reproductive tract, you know, with the exposures of the mom. I mean, if you ask me, I wouldn't know what kind of food my mother was eating, whether it came from cans that were lined in plastic. And so to find those things out is far more difficult than to go out into the field and study, you know, alligators in a lake or something.
Tom Zeller and Amherst, help us a little bit with the science here. I mean, the sources of this now seem to be just almost all over the place. I mean, I'm reading and learning as I read here about even women on birth control pills. The estrogen in those pills ends up through the sewer back in the water, in the water system, and humans end up getting it there too, as well as animals. Give us a sense of the science here, Tom Zeller. I mean, what is an endocrine? And endocrine effects, how does it go from being a chemical in a baby bottle or in our drinking water to apparently being connected to large increases in genital deformities in newborn humans? What's the chain of events or causation there?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there are several issues here. The first is that the endocrine system in humans and animals is very similar. So estrogen in a human is identical chemically to that of an alligator or a frog, etc. So the hormone systems among vertebrates are very similar. Second, these hormones don't really produce an action by themselves, but only act by binding to proteins in different parts of the body called receptors. Mm-hmm. Those receptors are available really for any chemical that has a structure similar enough to bind to it. So that leaves open the possibility that environmental chemicals can get into the system in some way and begin to bind to those receptors and exert some kind of action. For example, having a male fish make eggs, that sort of thing. It's also interesting to know that, for example, in food can linings and in plastic baby bottles, this chemical that everybody's really talking about was initially designed to be an estrogen. So it wasn't designed to be a plastic at the beginning. So it's not surprising in some ways that we're finding that these chemicals have estrogenic influences now that they're in the general population.
Lynn, how does it go then from being in the food chain, in the water supply, maybe in a baby bottle or some kitchen implement? How do you go from there to, in animals' case, intersex fish, where they have sort of evidence of both genders, or in humans' case, genital deformity? Where does the damage take place exactly?
Well, in terms of what's happening with the fish, when we use chemicals of various kinds, a lot of what we use winds up going down the drain one way or another, either because it's in soaps and other like products and we're using it in water, or because we're, in the case of birth control pills, we're taking the pills and then, of course, we are eliminating the metabolites of those pills and those are going into the water. And our water treatment systems don't actually efficiently remove these estrogens. And so there's a fair amount of estrogenic compounds that you can find in water, especially downstream from outfalls from water treatment plants, and the fish are affected by them.
And is it when they're before birth, in the egg or in utero, in the case of humans, that actually that estrogen has the effect of confusing the sexual manifestation of the newborn?
Well, see, what would happen is that a compound that's like an estrogen might do one of two things. It might actually, if it can fit into the estrogen receptor, it might turn on the cell to do what estrogen receptors make it do, which is to express more kind of feminine traits.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it can fit in the receptor, it might actually block the receptor. Much like, say, if you had a key fitting into a lock, that key might fit perfectly and then turn the lock. And actually, in the case of the estrogen receptor, you don't actually have a perfect fit to turn it because the estrogen receptor is not very well protected from things. Or you might have a key that doesn't quite fit but can get stuck in the lock and then block that lock from other keys going in. And so in one case, you'd get an effect that would be a pro-estrogen effect, feminizing effect. In the other case, if it's blocking, it might be like an anti-estrogenic effect or a masculinizing effect. So it's kind of complicated. And then some of these chemicals also can fit or block androgen receptors, male receptors. And so we often see that as a set of endpoints, certainly in the laboratory experiments, that chemicals are actually causing males born, male rats exposed in utero to be born looking more like females than they should because of blocking androgen.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about endocrine disruptors, the chemicals in everyday household products and in our water that may be changing everything from the sex organs of fish to the anatomies of our children. We're joined in this hour by Professor Thomas Zeller. He's at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, professor and chair of biology there. One of the authors of a big new statement by the Endocrine Society warning that we'd better pay attention to this. Lynn Goldman is with us. She's a pediatrician and epidemiologist. She's at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and worked with the EPA in the Clinton administration on exactly this issue. Tom Zeller, you're one of the co-authors of this big new statement from the Endocrine Society. Why now? 50 pages of a pretty dense message here. What prompted you all to come forward now and say, heads up here, everybody?
It's a good question. So there were probably a number of reasons that different people had to begin to produce this. One of my interests for a while is in trying to get basic endocrinology incorporated into the regulatory toxicology. One of the ways I think that we need to think about doing this is to make sure that endocrinologists are really aware of the way that these chemicals are being evaluated for their safety. And their, the traditional way, kind of toxicological method for evaluating these chemicals really cannot give us good information about how they may act as a hormone or hormone disruptor. So that was probably my biggest incentive for developing this statement so that basic endocrinologists across the country as well as physician endocrinologists can begin to understand what the data are completely and to become interested in this issue.
Are you suggesting that regular toxicology is kind of missing this class of chemicals or their effect, the way we test for it?
No, the way we test for it absolutely misses many of the effects of these chemicals on endocrine systems.
Lynn, what's the most striking evidence that is getting people's attention here? I mean, it can sound very scary, and does, when you talk about deformed animals, deformed humans. Lots of 7% of boys now born with undescended testicles, which I understand may be part of this whole picture. What's the most important evidence in the natural world that something may be going wrong here?
Well, certainly we are very concerned about our children and, boys born with undescended testicles, age of puberty. Many feel that girls are going through puberty earlier now than they used to. And that's something that actually we're working on in the context of the National Children's Study, which, by the way, I'm not principal investigator for the entire thing. I'm mm-hmm. principal investigator for the center at Hopkins.
Good.
It's very, very difficult to look at humans. And one thing that we are going to do with a National Children's Study is be able to look at the exposures that occur even before conception and through pregnancy and through early life in order to be able to get at some of these factors. We have had outbreaks of premature thalarche, girls who are 7 or 8 growing breasts, and which is of great concern in communities. This happened in Puerto Rico a few years ago, and we just don't have answers for why these things happen and what we can do to correct them. I think the other thing that's very striking right now is some of the new data that is being published on bisphenol A, and particularly recently a study indicating there might be an association with diabetes.
This is the chemical in plastics, in baby bottles, banned in Japan, I think, and maybe in Canada now, but not here.
Yes, it has been banned in Canada, and the European Union is reassessing it now. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is assessing it over again, did an assessment last year that its science review committee didn't agree with, and so they're having to go back to the drawing board and look at it again. And the thing is that, diabetes is an endocrine disease. It has to do with the insulin hormone and its release. And it really raises some questions about bisphenol A, not only in terms of the sex hormones, but also other hormones that regulate growth and that are involved with chronic disease. And we have such a huge epidemic of chronic disease in this country. It's an enormous cost in terms of health care, and very important, if we have chemicals that are involved in contributing to chronic disease, that's an enormous burden to society.
And, of course, we've seen quite a surge in diabetes. I want to begin to bring our listeners in here from Nashville, Tennessee. Claire. Hi, Claire. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your program.
Thank you.
I'm not sure about fish and amphibians, but I am sure about, what about genetically modified seeds? Wheat, rice, corn, soybeans, what's in them? Do we know, and do we know what the long-term effects are going to be? What about hormones that are put into animals we eat? What about hormones in milk? It seems that several years ago there was a big quarrel about the fact whether milk should be labeled that it contained hormones or not, but it does contain hormones. What about the chemicals in the fertilizers that we put on our food? For this reason, as much as possible, I eat only organic food, and I don't eat any animals.
Claire, it's a long list. Let us begin to pick it up. But I know exactly what you mean. It can begin to seem that in every which way you turn, there's a threat. On the other hand, and Tom Zeller and Lynn Goldman, let me put this to you as well as Claire's. Here's Emily, who's writing it at our Facebook page. She says, it's too simple to say all chemicals are bad. Doesn't benefit our society to create a general fear of chemicals. Chemicals are ubiquitous in our lives. Water is a chemical. It's a sad product of poor science education that such a fear can be perpetrated by the media. Tom, there you've got Claire, who's, she's got a very wide spectrum concern, and then Emily saying, let's settle down here. What do you say?
Right. Somewhere in between may be a good way to look at this. The way that I've been thinking of this recently is to think of it just in terms of good nutrition. So I think that the idea that we can eat whatever we want, whenever we want, is probably too simple. We need to think about the kind of foods that our body needs at different times during our development, our children, adulthood, the kind of even the jobs that we have, to what degree we have physical stressors, et cetera. So as we think just in general about good nutrition, we also need to think about the kinds of chemicals that we're being exposed to. And I think that it is a genuine concern that we're using many of these chemicals as agricultural agents, hormones in animals that can be high. We need to trust our government regulatory agencies to do the proper thing, proper testing, proper kind of safety guidelines, et cetera, because it's really too much for each individual to try to figure out what we're being exposed to. And I think it's very clear that we know that we're being exposed to many chemicals that that we're unaware of. So we need to balance our concern with I think, effective action. On the other hand, the idea comparing that, you know, water is a chemical with bisphenol A that is a chemical, those are two really different things. And other countries have shown that they can eliminate bisphenol A, for example, from food linings, food containers, and do fine. So I think that we do have to balance this, but we shouldn't disregard it either.
I guess not. I mean, Lynn, Tom says we need to trust our government agencies are on top of this, but needing to and actually being justified in that trust are two different things. I mean, as things stand right now, Lynn, can Americans trust that the government is really thoroughly paying attention to the chemicals in our environment and their impact on us? I'm not getting that impression from what I'm reading in background here.
Well, and so I used to be responsible for the regulation of chemicals in the country, mm-hmm. and I can tell you that the government has not done what it needs to do. We need to have a much more rational basis for the regulation of chemicals in the United States. And I agree with the comment that not all chemicals are bad. Of course they're not all bad. And of course we get a lot of benefits from the use of chemicals in our society. But chemicals are on the market in the United States without any real prior testing and assessment. And once they're on the market, it's very difficult to remove them. And we just don't have a system that requires that we take a careful look at them before we market them. Pesticides, on the other hand, are tested first. And I think that we need to have a system that makes sure that the chemicals that we're exposed to on a day-to-day basis, that, you know, that they've been evaluated and that we know that they're safe. Otherwise, it is very easy to then just be fearful that everything is unsafe and to be, you know, concerned that you have to avoid everything. And there's no way that consumers can deal with that. And I think that this is an area that's just ripe for governmental reform efforts, and where I hope that both of your callers will support those efforts, because it really, really would be helpful if we had a law that required the EPA to actually give us a safety assurance for chemicals.
We'll talk more about our system and what's in the law and what's not. Let's get a call here from Tamara in Natick, Massachusetts. Tamara, you're on the air.
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call and for doing this program. I'm an epidemiologist, and I also study this. And I just wanted to kind of bring attention to studying this in personal care products. A lot of people use products like cosmetics, hair products, and so on that contain phthalates, parabens, placenta-based products that, to their knowledge, they aren't aware of them actually putting them on their bodies. And I guess my question is, how do we go about studying these? We've just recently had a seminar here in the Boston area, mm-hmm. and one of our issues is that it's hard to work with companies to try to get them to release what they're in fact putting into their products. And so how do we study them to find out if they are having a harmful effect on human health? And then whose responsibility is it really? You just mentioned that maybe the EPA should get in on this and so on, but is it the FDA's responsibility to ensure public safety against personal care products? And so I just would like to know what the speakers have to say about that.
Let us pick it up, Tamara, and thank you for your call. Lynn, this is kind of back in your former EPA bailiwick. What about personal care products? What are the risks there?
Well, that's a really good question, and I've wondered about that a lot myself. The responsibility is kind of shared between EPA in terms of fundamentally looking at the chemicals, but the products themselves are in the FDA, cosmetics, and that part of FDA's law is not very strong. It's not anything close to what you think about the FDA in terms of how strict it is about pharmaceuticals.
For those of us who aren't epidemiologists, I couldn't quite follow Tamara's quick description there. I mean, what are the potential risk factors in chemicals, in what kind of cosmetics or personal care products?
Well, here's what I personally have been worried about. I'm not only a pediatrician, but I'm also a mother. And I'm a mother of a daughter who, by the time she was 2 years old, as soon as we went into a pharmacy, she immediately would notice something that I never saw, which is down at her eye level, about 2 feet from the ground, there was a display of glittery, sparkly things like nail polish and, you know, lip gloss and things that's obviously marketed right to her. And You pick up those products and look at them. There is no indication of what's in them. You have no idea what's in them. And if you've ever put nail polish on the fingernails of a three-year-old and then watched it disappear within a day, where do you think it's going?
But what might be? I haven't even got the vaguest idea. I don't know what's in glittery nail polish. Maybe you don't either.
They don't have to tell us what's in it.
But what could it be going after our endocrine?
Well, there could be phthalates. System. These chemicals called phthalates. They have endocrine properties. They block androgen. They have some estrogenic properties, and there are many, many more. I also can't tell you what all the chemicals are that are in these nail polishes. I don't have any idea myself, but I do know that some testing has found phthalates. And we also know that women generally have higher levels of phthalates in their bodies than men, and this is one big difference between the environment of most women and most men. Women generally use more cosmetics, and so it's, you know, possibly even a relationship that would kind of make sense. And think about this also. There are women and men who work in the cosmetology industry and all day long have a lot of contact with these products, not just with casual use, and have a lot of potential for exposure. And she asked, is there a way to study this? One thing that one might do is study those people and see what their exposure levels are. I have a suspicion that you might see higher phthalate levels in people who work with these products.
It can begin to sound like our economy is awfully deeply tied up with these chemicals. Let's go to Susan in Beckett, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading in a book called Poison Prophets, The Toxic Assault on Our Children, very much about the same topic. In fact, Dr. Zoller was interviewed for that book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also found from the book that some of the studies that seem to make it safe for us to use these products are actually produced by influence. Like there was somebody looked at the 115 published studies of the effects of these chemicals on lab animals and found that 90% of the studies done by independent researchers found that bisphenol A was harmful, including to brain chemistry of kids, whereas all the studies paid for by chemical industries absolved the chemical of any harm. So I wonder if the scientists could tell us what the influence of industry has been on allowing these chemicals to stay in for decades and decades.
It's a good question, Susan. Let us pick it up here before the break, which is coming soon. Thank you for your call, Tom Zeller. How about it? Is the industry in here resisting regulation or financing research that goes against mainstream research? What?
I think there are certainly good examples of that. Bisphenol A is probably one of the best examples of that, the clearest. There was an article in the Washington Post several weeks ago about a meeting by industries that use bisphenol A, really trying to develop a strategy to keep it on the market and to essentially obfuscate. That would be the way I see it. It is true also that a number of studies that are funded by industry failed to identify harmful effects of bisphenol A. Some of that, it's possible, could be the way those studies are being performed. That is, if you look in a general way at the ability of bisphenol A to influence organ weight, et cetera, it's not as sensitive as a modern endocrinologist would use to look at brain development or other kinds of mechanisms. So I think there's a combination of things that are occurring here. Different industries approach it differently, but certainly there are good examples of what this caller's concern was.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about endocrine disruptors, the class of chemicals in everyday household products and in our water that may be changing everything from the sex organs of fish to the anatomies of our children. Professor Thomas Zeller joins us from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And from Washington, D.C., we're joined by Lynn Goldman. She's a professor at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins there. Under President Clinton, she was at the EPA, Assistant Administrator for the Office of Prevention, Pesticides, and Toxic Substances, both joining us. Let's go to Judy in Faiston, Vermont. Judy, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. And hello, hello, hello. Thank you so much for this program. It's decades overdue. I was living in the Upper Hudson Valley when GE was dumping PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, into the Hudson. And I worked on that project, and that got stopped in 76. I am one for scientific facts, to be accurate, although I'm not a scientist. Mm. And I will end this with quick thing with two sentences out of the condensed chemical dictionary that people would be interested in about the polyvinyl chloride, which is the plasticizer that's used in so many things. One line: the possibility of migration of vinyl chloride into food products is a critical factor. And for vinyl chloride itself, which is in polyvinyl chloride, the hazard, it says, is an extremely toxic and hazardous material by all avenues of exposure, a carcinogen. And that's PVCs. I do not put in the freezer, heat, cold, or anything in plastics anymore. And the fact that they sell things to be heated or cooked in plastic, to me, it borders on criminal. And this should have been taken care of long ago. Thank you so much.
Judy, thank you very much for your call. Lynn, there's a lot there. But first of all, Judy says this should have been addressed decades ago. You were right there in the EPA, right kind of in the middle of this. You were testifying all the way back in 1993. That is many years ago now. And as I recall reading about your testimony there, you were talking about damage to sex organs and testicles. You got a lot of congressmen's attention in a hurry. Here we are, 15 years later, and how much has changed? Why hasn't this been taken up more assiduously, Lynn?
Well, you know, in 1996, the Congress required the EPA to develop a program to screen and test chemicals and pesticides for endocrine disruptor potential. And I actually led an effort while I was at the EPA, an advisory group that brought together scientists from across the whole spectrum, and we developed a program. And we turned it into Congress by the due date. And then over the last 8 years in the Bush administration, very little happened. Things moved very, very slowly. And, in fact, it wasn't until about a year ago that we finally saw an announcement for the first small group of chemicals that are going to go through this screening process, which has been, you know, quite a disappointment to me personally, and not the least of which that, you know, we would know so much more today if this had been implemented and if we had seen some action by the EPA during that time, but also that now we're looking at a whole screening and testing program that, you know, where 10 years has elapsed without essentially any new science being injected into it. They've done a little few tweaks here and there and certainly have probably improved the assays. I don't want to denigrate what they've done, but
but what's the problem here, Professor?
Lost a lot of momentum.
But is there some scientific ambiguity? Is this straight up industry opposition to what might cost to take certain products off the market or cost industry more? I mean, Tom Zeller mentioned this meeting that the Washington Post reported back in May in Washington, where about public relations for some of these chemicals. And they said they were looking for a spokesperson. Their holy grail would be a pregnant young mother for a spokesperson who would be willing to speak around the country about the benefits of bisphenol A. I mean, for goodness sakes, is it industry opposition or ambiguity about the science, Professor Goldman?
Well, I know that they do, organize themselves to oppose regulation, companies do, and that's certainly part of what they do. And I think there's another issue as well, which is that endocrine disruption per se isn't a health effect. It's a mode of action. It's a way a lot of other health effects can happen, from birth defects to cancer. You've mentioned a number of them. And I think there's a lot of fear on the part of industry of having a product that they make labeled an endocrine disruptor per se and pressure to, ban the substance or eliminate the substance on the basis of that whether, you know, without waiting to see whether, well, does it actually cause a health problem? And I think that's been one of the sticking points is that issue. I think some of the scientists involved in the government and have been uncomfortable with changing the traditional ways that they used to evaluate chemicals. And, you know, Tom Zoller mentioned earlier on the show that, you know, some of the older testing schemes don't really look at endocrine effects in an up-to-date way. But those scientists are very familiar with those ways of testing. They're very used to comparing chemicals using those tests. And so there's probably also just some resistance built into the system to any kind of change at all.
But they work for us, and who cares if they're comfortable with the old way? I mean, Tom Zeller, we've got here from our website, Todd says, government, if we rely on the government to solve the problem of environmental chemical hazards, then no solution will ever be forthcoming. I mean, we hate to look at it that way, Professor, but what about it? I mean, how fierce is the opposition, and where do you see it primarily coming from?
Well, I think the opposition is well organized, and I think it comes from industries that both make and use these kind of chemicals. I think another very good example is that of perchlorate that is used by the defense industries. And here's a chemical that in many ways differs from the common profile. For example, your most recent caller talked about polychlorinated biphenyls. These are chemicals that are still with us today. That is, probably every human in this country has PCBs in their bloodstream and in their tissues, despite the fact that their production was banned in this country in the 70s. So these things are very long-lived. In contrast, perchlorate is a chemical that gets into the water supply from a number of sources, but largely defense industries, and contaminates everyone. So we know that these industries have organized themselves around studies that essentially show this chemical to be safe. I think that we, you know, there's not much alternative to the government. Individuals simply can't do the kind of either studies or the kinds of measurements to know what is in your food. So we have to rely on government. We have to facilitate, I think, you know, a governmental system that is going to be both responsive and kind of top flight.
But I mean, the elephant in the room here, our caller Judy said earlier, it's almost criminal. I mean, don't gild the lily at all here for us. It sounds as though each of you are very diplomatically saying that we've got a real problem that is a threat to animals and to humans now, and I'm reading here maybe for generations to come, that's straight up not being addressed. Is that fair?
We've just come through.
Lynn? Lynn?
We've just come through a very anti-science era in government, where we had a government that tried to deny global warming and also, you know, by the way, failed to, as Congress told it to do, you know, screen and test chemicals for endocrine disruption potential. And there are a lot of other things that were failures during that era. And I think what we have to do is, in every possible way, let the government know that the public, the taxpayers, do expect these things to be addressed and that they are addressed properly and using the best available science.
Let's go to Evans, Georgia, and Sheldon. Hi, Sheldon. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a quick statement, more or less, that our bodies are a rather balanced system, and it's built up to deal with a lot of these things. However, since we are in a consumer-driven society, these corporations are more or less in control of what we eat and how we are fed, etc. The government's very limited to how to control this, and I don't see this clearing up in our systems for generations to come. Even if there's a solution, there'll be fewer generations down the line before you even see a massive change.
But is there any alternative to government providing some kind of oversight and regulation? I mean, you heard Sheldon Tom Zeller saying individuals can just about not address this themselves here. It's too much. Yeah, Tom, how about it? I mean, Sheldon says, you know, sort of live healthy, and maybe our bodies can deal with this. But he's right. We live in an economy that seems to provide these chemicals or include them at almost every turn.
Right. I think that there are places that the government can take action relatively quickly. One is to ensure that we know what is in all of our products. So if for example, when you go to buy a lotion or sunscreen or whatever it might be, if you know exactly what is in there, consumers can begin to make that choice. I think bisphenol A is kind of a good example of that in the case that consumers became much more interested before the FDA became interested in the safety. And as a result, large corporations responded. For example, Walmart, I think, began eliminating products that had bisphenol A, et cetera. So I do think that if the government requires a full accounting for all the chemicals that are in a product that they sell to people, people can begin to make choices that I think will alter the landscape to an extent. At the same time, there's no doubt that we need to move away from the ability of a relatively small number of people, even in a single governmental office, that can allow the agenda to be sort of watered down toward these issues. We need to really get the best and brightest people in position to make the kind of decisions about how these chemicals are going to be regulated.
And I think that
it won't take that long. We've seen, for example, changes in lead, in blood lead levels in children change relatively rapidly. We've still got a ways to go. But I think that it's really not that bad, and the government can make a difference pretty quickly.
Sounds like we should make it snappy here. Let's go to Mia in Boston. Mia, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm one of the coordinators of the National Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, and we work to get endocrine disruptors and other really nasty chemicals out of personal care products using both the market and state and federal legislation.
Great.
And I've also worked with other consumer rights and environmental health advocates on bisphenol A. Mm-hmm. And I want to make one important point here. When we're talking about the birth control pill or other ways that we're exposed to these hormones, some of those are health choices that women are making to make reproductive decisions that are very empowering for them, versus hormone disruptors leaching from our canned foods, our hand soap, our baby shampoo. These are companies that are going out of their way to either hide information or purposely confuse the consumer and lobby against state and federal legislation. I think that this is a huge problem and that we need to see action both on an individual level, and we need to call our state and federal elected officials and demand accountability.
Mia, thanks for that. Lynn Goldman, Mia saying, let's make distinctions here. Maybe there's utility in some of these things that I guess may offset, as she sees it, some of the risks. But in other cases, she just sees plain out kind of obfuscation.
Well, I do think that there is an issue that people have to make a choice whether or not to take a birth control pill. I wouldn't say, though, that we are making a choice to put the residues of the birth control pill into our rivers. And we still have an issue about how we treat wastewater and trying to keep those hormones out of the environment.
Because those estrogens in the birth control pill will end up back in the water supply and in our drinking water currently.
That's right. They will. And we need the birth control pills, and they are important. And we also need to pay attention to how our wastewater is affecting the environment and do what we can to protect the environment. That's another place where probably only the government can step in and be helpful.
Could those endocrine disruptors be removed from our drinking water? Is that possible? Is it too costly to try and do it? Or could we just, dump something else in there that would fix it?
Yeah, there are ways to treat the water, but they might well be costly as well. And so those are the kinds of things that that people are working on, are ways to retool the waste treatment so that we don't have as many of these wastes, if you may, going down the drain and then, obviously at some point winding up back in our drinking water as well as in the ecosystem.
Our time is short. Clearly, both of you are making the case for Americans to raise the loud and clear demand for some more oversight here at the government level. While they may be doing that, what about at the personal level, Lynn? If people want to minimize their own or their family's exposure here, what are the sort of top things they can do? It can sound scary when Mia's talking about this stuff leaching from our canned foods. That's sitting right in our cupboard. What are your top few things people can do?
Well, first and foremost, I think that one of the callers mentioned it, you know, the food containers, to be very careful about how you use them. And I get calls from people who are doing things like taking plastic water bottles and heating water in them in the microwave. And, you know, many plastics are not microwave safe, and you shouldn't put anything in a microwave or, for that matter, in a dishwasher unless it's labeled as being safe to be exposed to that kind of heat, because a lot of these plastics melt or partially melt, and then they release a lot more of these chemicals. And, you know, you can hunt for water bottles, you know, bisphenol-free bottles. You certainly can avoid unnecessary use of chemicals. There's a lot of use of chemicals that as you can use a softer method for cleaning. You can use a softer method for pest control. And you don't need to have that aerosol pesticide there to spray the flying insects or whatever. You can control them in softer ways. And there's a lot of good information about that, by the way, on EPA's webpage and in a lot of other places. And I think that we've kind of been taught that we need to have chemicals to, you know, protect us from pathogens and protect us from bugs and to make our houses smell good, and that, you know, we're just dispersing by choice too many chemicals into our environment, and where we could make our houses smell better just by, you know, airing them out.
Open the windows.
And instead of putting that thing in there that releases chemicals.
And it sounds like, above all, let your congressman or woman know that you're paying attention and want the government paying attention here, too, as to what is in our environment. Really eye-opening conversation. I want to thank each of you. Lynn Goldman at Johns Hopkins, thank you so much for being with us today, Professor Goldman.
Thank you for having me.
And Tom Zeller, one of the authors of the Big New Report from the Endocrine Society, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. Be careful out there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.